Now, it would be interesting if we had time to go around everyone in the congregation, not to mention the ones in Zoom, and ask them what's the first thought that comes into their mind if I say the word law. I don't know what it would be, but I would guess that a lot of it would probably be not directly related to what the Bible understands by law at all. We tend to look at what the Bible says about law in terms of our encounter with, say, the civil law, which is usually, we think of it as a list of things that we can do. Well, actually, it's usually a list of things we can't do, and the consequences then for getting caught, if we're caught doing them or not doing them, as the case may be. Now, there is, of course, that aspect in God's law, but I would suggest it's not really the primary aspect of what the Bible thinks of in terms of the law. In Hebrew, the word, of course, used is Torah, and that doesn't directly correspond to our word law at all. But if you were to try and summarize what the people in the Old Testament would have understood by Torah, it would be essentially one of the expressions, perhaps the main expression, of being in covenant with God. And we're going to look and tease that out a little bit as we go along. So it's essentially seen as a positive thing. So again and again in the Psalms, you hear the psalmist saying on behalf of the people of Israel that they are blessed because God has given them his law. It's seen more as a blessing. It's seen as a blessing, really, not as a burden. Now, of course, we're acknowledging the fact that the people struggled, to put it kindly, to keep the law, never succeeded. Even Moses, the lawgiver, didn't fully succeed in keeping the law. But the giving of the law itself was an expression of them being God's people. They were given that because they were in relationship with God. It was part of the way of expressing. Now, that's not accidental, and it harps back to creation, as we'll see as we go along. So I want to sort of set this in your mind, that when we're thinking of the law, we primarily, as Christians, think of being delivered from the consequences of having broken the law, and that's true, that's one of the things that the gospel does. But the fact that we have broken the law is not what defines what the law actually is. What defines what the law is what God says initially in giving the law. All right, so in paragraph 1 of the Confession of Faith, in this chapter, chapter 19, it starts really where you always have to start, in Genesis. Because what Genesis does, it allows us, at least in the first two chapters, to look at things as they were originally and as they were meant to be, rather than through the lens of how things turned out. Because it's very hard, isn't it, when you start looking at how things turned out. In other words, as sinners, if we start looking at the law, by definition, it's going to have a very different aspect, isn't it? You know, if you met a burglar on the street and asked him what did he think of the law, well, he would give you a definition, but it would have been tainted, I think, with his condition and his experience. So, they say, God gave to Adam a law of universal obedience written in his heart. Now, I think they're saying something very important there, the fact that it's not only is it true, but when we come to the New Covenant, and God talks about writing the law, and it was quoted there in Hebrews 10, on people's hearts, in a sense, it's part of recreating things as God always meant them to be. And the particular precept of not eating the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, by which he bound him and all his posterity to personal, entire, exact, and perpetual obedience, promised life upon the fulfilling and threatened death upon the breach of it, and, very, very importantly, endued him with power and ability to keep it. Which means what? Well, it means as part of our human nature, original in Adam, before the fall, humanity were able to know and actually do what God required. That's why I said it's important to go back to Genesis, because then you're getting a clear-eyed look at what humanity was meant to be, not what we actually are now. And thankfully, not what we'll continue to be. Furthermore, both the requirements of God's law and the blessing of obedience, as well as the punishment for disobedience, were known to Adam and descend to his offspring as part of our human nature. which, by the way, is what Paul is referring to in Romans 2 when he talks about the law being written on the heart. He's not saying that the new covenant is fulfilled in all of the Gentiles by their nature, but he says there's a certain knowing of what's right and wrong in every human being. There's a sense that there's a right and there's a wrong. It's not a perfect knowledge, because that only comes from God's word by the Holy Spirit. So some scriptures then that we can look at from which this truth is distilled, Genesis 1:27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Now, even by that statement alone, it's saying that man was created perfect, isn't it? Because you could not be created in the image of God and be imperfect. That would be a contradiction in terms. And so when he gives Adam the specific instructions that we see in Genesis 2, it's really only the outworking of the relationship that's there by creation in Genesis chapter 1. And that's probably what's meant in Ecclesiastes 7 when it says, "Truly, this only have I found, God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes." Which demolishes, by the way, that get-out clause that many people will give themselves. Well, this is the way God made me. No, this is the way humanity has made you, and you've made yourself. You know, the responsibility for us being how we are now is not that God made us that way, but that Adam deviated from God's plan, and the rest of us have compounded that in literally billions of ways. So, we come to then whenever God gives the law at Sinai, and it's quoted here in Romans 10, Moses writes of the righteousness that is based on the law. The person who performs them will live by them. Now, it goes on to deal with the fact, of course, that as sinners now, we cannot do that, but that was the original plan and purpose. Adam could do that because he had a perfect nature. And then, of course, the dilemma that we have is outlined in Galatians 3. As many as are of the works of the law are under its curse. Well, why would that be the case? Why? Because it's written, "Cursed is everyone who does not continue in all things that are written in the book of the law." But why are they under a curse? They're under a curse because they're covenant breakers. "Yet the law is not of faith, but the man who does them shall live by them." So, here we see an anticipation of the gospel, don't we? The gospel is needed to construct that new covenant relationship in which this problem here can only be resolved. So, in paragraph 2, it goes on to say, "The same law, first written in the heart of man, continued to be a perfect rule of righteousness after the fall." Now here we're dealing with a very, very important concept. That just because man rejected God's standard, that didn't mean that God's standard ceased to be the standard. And so when we see God calling a people to himself in the deliverance of the Israelites from Egypt, he established a covenant with them in the Ten Commandments, as I say here, written on two tables, the first four containing our duty towards God and the other our duty towards man. Now, if you notice here, there is a change of the location of the law. The same law first written in the heart of man, it's now written, which is internal, isn't it? It's an internalization. The relationship with God is perfect between him and Adam. So what God requires isn't out there, it's in here, written on the heart. But at Sinai, it's not. It's written on two tables, the two tables of stone. It's external. It's in the same law, but there's a problem now. It's out there because the relationship hasn't been properly restored, has it? So it's an external, same law, same requirements, because God doesn't change, his requirements doesn't change, we change. And it contains, and they summarize it here very much the same way that Jesus summarizes it in the New Testament, our duties towards God and our duties towards each other. Those things cannot change and don't change. And of course, the unwritten implication here is that if there is change, what has to change is us. The question is, how does that happen? All right, so what we're saying here is even after Adam's fall, God's requirements don't change. Man is made in God's image and God can't change. And then the law which reflects and expresses this reality cannot change. In one sense, this is just really defining the problem, but it's also anticipating the solution, because at least we know where the change is going to have to happen. On Sinai, God delivered this reality afresh to his people as he called them, in the words of Deuteronomy, to be a holy people to himself. Now notice the emphasis here is on relationship. Just as he has sworn to you, if you keep the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in his ways. And so Israel, totally oblivious of, initially at least, their inability to keep these commandments, rejoiced that God had given them these commandments, that this law, which summarized and expressed the fact that they were in a covenant relationship with God. Deuteronomy 10, then he wrote on the tablets, like the first writing. This is very important, because you remember when Moses came down the first time from the mountain, and before he even came back down into the camp, he realized that already Israel was breaking the law by worshipping the golden calf. And in frustration, he dashes the table to the ground, and I suppose very graphically we see that the tablets of the law broken, even as the law itself has been broken. So what happens? God calls him back up to the mountain, and God kind of lowers the standard, right, because he knows, no. When he comes down the second time, what's written on the tablets? Exactly the same as what was written on them the first time. Which God, the Lord, had spoken to you on the mountain from the midst of the fire on the day of the assembly, and the Lord gave them to me. And so they're being reminded here in Deuteronomy, almost towards the end now of the 40 years, of who they are, what it's all about, and God giving them this law as an expression of who he is and who they're called to be. And this is the verse I referred to earlier, that although this is given in a very specific and explicit way to the people of Israel, in one sense, God hasn't left humanity without some level of testimony that there is right and there is wrong. As Paul expresses there in Romans 2, as you see, when the Gentiles who do not have the law, he's talking there about the law of Moses, by nature do the things in the law, these are not, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves, their thoughts accusing or else excusing them. And, if you study some of the law codes of the ancient world, they haven't got the perfection in them that, say, the law of Moses has, but there are remarkable similarities. People are conscious that there are certain things are right to do and certain things are wrong to do. In the third paragraph, we actually move then to another aspect of the law. Besides this law, commonly called moral. And by moral we mean it has to do with who we are, our concepts of right and wrong, and the idea of being accountable to God for what is right and wrong. God was pleased to give the people of Israel ceremonial laws. In fact, if you read through Exodus, Leviticus, the vast majority of what you're reading is going to be ceremonial laws. The different types of sacrifices, how to construct the temple, the role of the priests, how they were to dress, how they were to offer this sacrifice, how they were to offer that sacrifice, and so on, the various feasts, and so on. So, what was the point of this? Well, they contained several typical ordinances, partly of worship, prefiguring Christ, his graces, actions, sufferings, and benefits, partly holding forth various instructions of moral duties. Some of them were practical applications of the Ten Commandments in various situations. you know, duties of people towards each other as masters and slaves, men and women and so on. All of which ceremonial laws being appointed only to the time of reformation are, by Jesus Christ, the true Messiah and only lawgiver, who was furnished with power from the Father for that end, abrogated and taken away. Yeah, that very, very long sentence. I think we could try and summarize it and condense it in our thinking this way. As well as the Ten Commandments, Israel was given ceremonial laws. These portrayed for the people spiritual truths concerning worship, and in particular pointed forward to the coming Messiah, who would fulfill in person, completely and finally, what they portrayed partially and in an ongoing way. So in other words, they were in a real way, albeit a partial way, portraying certain truths about worship, how God would be approached, but also they were portraying partially, although truly, what the Messiah would be like when he would come. Think of the Day of Atonement, for example, where once, and that's what's referred to here in Hebrews 10, where they had this national day of acknowledging sin and in a ceremonial way placing that sin on the substitute and the substitute carrying it away, not only from them but out of God's sight, as it were, for the year. And of course that's, as Hebrews 10 reminds us, what that did in a ceremonial way, Christ did in a real way, not just partially, not just once a year, but forever. Okay. So that was part of the role of the ceremonial law. The coming of Jesus the Messiah has made these laws redundant. So any attempt to continue them takes away from his completed work. So if we continue to sort of build a temple and have an altar and a priesthood and offer sacrifice and take away sins, it would be wrong. It wouldn't just be redundant, it would be wrong, because Christ has fulfilled that for us. Hebrews 10, we looked at it already. For the law, speaking here of the ceremonial law, having a shadow of the good things to come and not the very image of the things, can never with these same sacrifices which they offer continually year by year make those who approach perfect. They were outlining the fact that we needed to be made perfect. They were outlining the fact of how we would be made perfect by a perfect substitute on our behalf, but they themselves didn't accomplish what they were portraying. It's a bit like, and the word here of a shadow gives us the idea of, you know, an outline of the person, but not the person themselves, you know. And I've often given the illustration, if you're going to meet somebody and you meet at a corner and the sun is behind that person, before you actually meet them, you can see the shadow. But once they turn the corner, I hope you wouldn't keep looking at the shadow. Automatically you look at the person, don't you? And the person is the reality that the shadow tells you is coming. That the shadow gives you something of a true glimpse of what they're going to be like. And if it's a certain person or a certain shape, you probably know from the shadow that it is actually them. But once they come, automatically your eyes lift from the shadow to the real person. And that's, in a sense, the argument of Hebrews, really, isn't it? The real person has come. Don't continue to be preoccupied with the shadows. And Paul uses something of that argument in 1 Corinthians 5. He uses an argument, you'd have to be familiar with the Old Testament ceremonial law to actually get it. And he's talking about sin here, but he uses an Old Testament picture to describe it. Therefore, purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump. Since you truly are unleavened, he keeps mixing his metaphors here, but you have to know the metaphors to get it. For indeed, Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. Basically, his argument here is that Christ is the real Passover, which the old Passover merely prefigured. And then because he has done what he has done, we need to, in thanksgiving to him, live in a totally different way. Paul continues to use a similar argument in Ephesians 2, where he talks about the physical construction of the temple, which also reflected the construction of the tabernacle, whereby there were divisions there. There were divisions, first of all, where only the high priest could go, where only the priest could go, where only the people of Israel could go, and then outside was where everybody else could come, where only the Gentiles could go. But all that's gone now, he says. Look at Ephesians 2. For he himself, speaking of Jesus, is our peace, who has made both one and has broken down the middle wall of separation, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, that is the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so as to create in himself one new man from the two. And here he hasn't primarily in mind the moral law, the Ten Commandments, which he reminds us in Romans 2, apply to all of humanity, even though the Gentiles have only a limited understanding of it. They have an understanding that there is a moral law because they try and do moral things and they feel convicted when they don't. So that's not what he has in mind here. He has in mind the ceremonial law, which made the distinction between Jews and Gentiles in terms of worship. But that distinction is gone. You know, remember, he prefigured this when he talked to the woman at the well. He was a Samaritan. They argued, well, Samaritan said, well, if you worship on Mount Gerizim, that's the place to worship. And the Jews correctly knew that Jerusalem was the place to worship. But Jesus said, these distinctions, the Jews, by the way, were right, but these distinctions are going to go. Because it's not where you worship is going to be important. It never really was, but now it's certainly not going to be important. It's who and how you worship. Not, neither on this mountain nor Jerusalem will you worship, but people will worship God in spirit and in truth. God is spirit, and those who worship must worship in spirit and in truth. And that, of course, is what he accomplishes here, as Paul says, that he might reconcile them both to God in one body, one community of people, through the cross, thereby putting to death the enmity. So as we begin to look at God's law, the first thing we want to get across is that let's start looking at it, how the Bible describes it, and not really our idea of law. The primary idea is that law expresses relationship with God. Sadly, as sinners, it expresses broken relationship, but the whole idea initially was that Adam did what God said because he wanted to do it, because he was made in God's image. It was a way of him expressing who he was as a human being. And when he stopped doing that, in one sense, not only is his relationship with God broken, but there's something broken in his humanity. And we see that immediately, don't we? He starts blaming his wife. They have two kids. One of them kills the other. You know, there's something broken, not just in his relationship with God, but in his essential humanity. So as creatures made in God's image, Adam was given a commandment as to how he must live to please God. And he's also given the power to do it. It wasn't a difficult thing. It was his natural orientation until he sinned to want to live to please God. Secondly, even after Adam sinned, this requirement remained essential to human nature. It didn't go away because it couldn't go away. And so as we look at our broken world, it's screaming in pain at us. This is not the way it should be. There's something wrong. There's something drastically wrong. There's something drastically missing. What's missing, of course, is relationship with God. And so unsurprisingly, a world of the broken law is crying out to us, there's broken relationship with God. You're not in covenant with God, your covenant breakers. And at Sinai, thirdly, in the Old Covenant, this reality is codified in what we call the Ten Commandments. I think it's called the Ten Words, isn't that right, in Hebrew? And it expresses how God's people ought to live, but not only how they ought to live, how they ought to want to live. The privilege of God stripping away all the confusion and says, this is what I am like, and therefore this is what you should be like. Be holy, even as I am holy. But even in the giving of it, portrayed dramatically with Moses coming down and smashing the tablets as he sees them worshipping the golden calf, even in the giving of it, we're confronted with there's something drastically missing. Because even though we now can see afresh who God is, what we are like or supposed to be like, we're confronted even more acutely with the fact that that's not what we're like. And so, as the covenant is given on Sinai, there is immediately given with it the need for something to change for the new covenant. And that's what Jeremiah does. Because in a sense, the brokenness of the covenant that we see, even on Sinai, while it's been given, reaches its crescendo, doesn't it, in the exile. When this people who are privileged to be given the covenant are confirmed as covenant breakers, and you say, well, where is their hope? And he says, but it's going to be a new covenant. Which won't change who God is. Nor will it change what we are required to be, but it will do amazing things. It's not resolved in that promise how it's going to happen, but it's enough that the promise is made. And this is the covenant I will make it with them after those days, says the Lord. I will write the Torah on their hearts. Not on pieces of stone. And some commentator, I forget, probably a Puritan, but I forget who it was, said that in the giving of the first law, the tablets are broken. In the giving of the new law, the hearts are broken and made new by the writing of the law. If I get that quote, I'll give it to you, Craig. That's the gist of it, which I thought was a beautiful picture. And I will write them on their minds, and their sins and their iniquities I will remember no more. The brokenness of the people is now the gateway for the wholesomeness of a restored relationship with God. And finally, in the ceremonial law, these inadequacies of people's sin, as well as the promise of the Redeemer, which is another way of the promise of the new covenant. The promise of the new covenant is made explicit, of course, in Jeremiah 31, but it's already there in the ceremonial law that comes with the old covenant. Most of which has to do with their sin, hasn't it, and the breaking of the covenant. And God is saying, I'm not giving up on you. Yes, you're covenant breakers, but I'm faithful to the covenant. And I'm going to provide a way where we can be reconciled in this very covenant, not by changing me, but by changing you. It's the wonder of the gospel, isn't it? The coming of Jesus makes this law redundant.